So for today, let's get after it. We're going to be hearing from David Osgo, our Chief Economist. David will be taking you through the latest sales and distilled spirits category data. We'll also have Christine LoCascio. She's our Head of International Affairs, and she's going to discuss the impact of our industry as it relates to the retaliatory tariffs that we've been contending with over the last 9 months. And we're also privileged to be joined by Scott Harris. He's the founder of Catoctin Creek Distillery in Virginia, and he's going to discuss the impact of the retaliatory tariffs, particularly as it relates to the smaller distillers and the craft distillers around the country. I'm proud to stand here today and say that this is another record year for the distilled spirits industry. 2018 marked the ninth straight year of market share gains for the U.S. distilled spirits industry. Let me just repeat that. 2018 marked the ninth straight year of market share gains for the U.S. distilled spirits industry. We had a year of robust growth in revenues, up 5.1%, and volume was up 2.2%. The trend remains strong for continued consumer demand for super premium spirits products. That basically means that consumers are drinking up and drinking better. The spirits industry continues to be an important contributor to the nation's economy, and it's a key profit center for the hospitality sector. The sector generates over $178 billion in economic activity, over a million jobs, and nearly $30 billion in tax revenue every year. Across the country, there's been an explosion in craft distillers. These small distilleries are boosting tourism, driving local agriculture, and supporting surrounding businesses. And Scott will be able to elaborate on that a little bit more. This past year, we've had significant victories, including protecting our consumers and our companies from tax hikes in 19 states. The defeat of these tax threats have saved the distilled spirits industry $540 million in revenue. We were also successful in knocking down archaic banning Sunday sales of distilled spirits in Indiana and Tennessee. So in other words, in Indiana and Tennessee, if you want to go buy your favorite bottle of distilled spirits, you'll be able to do that on a Sunday. Since 2002, 20 states have passed Sunday sales legislation for distilled spirits, bringing the total of 42 states across the country. Legislators and consumers agree that these prohibition-era blue laws make no sense in today's modern marketplace. Sunday is now the second-best shopping day of the week. Lastly, I'm happy to report Georgians are cheering for the brunch bill that was passed in early, allowing earlier sales of alcohol at restaurants. Consumers in more than 45 localities throughout the Peach State can enjoy a Bloody Mary with their brunch. Importantly, another highlight of 2018 was our continued progress on the social responsibility front. It goes without saying that our industry is on the front lines and fully committed to combating underage drinking and drunk driving. This is a critical component to everything that we do. The federal government studies show that underage drinking and binge drinking have continued their long-term decline here in the U.S., and that's something that we're fully committed to maintaining and pushing forward on in the future. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, alcohol-impaired driving fatalities as a percent of total vehicle traffic fatalities is at its lowest level since 1982. I think we can all be proud of that, but there's still more work to be done. The spirits sector has been a part of this progress through the evidence-based programs by responsibility.org, and we actively support comprehensive anti-drunk driving legislation that's considered all throughout the country and in the states. While our country has worked together to bring down the number of drunk driving fatalities, important to note that impaired driving is on the rise. So what's that mean? According to the report from the Governor's Highway Safety Association, in 2016, 44% of fatality injured drivers with known results tested positive for drugs. This is up from 28% just 10 years earlier. The spirits industry is supporting efforts to address this growing problem by providing funding for advanced law enforcement training, and we're lobbying in support of funding in the development of accurate and reliable roadside testing technology, very similar to a breathalyzer. For the years ahead, and for this year, there are a number of key priorities for our spirits sector. At the federal level, we continue to urge the administration and our trading partners with China, Mexico, Canada, to bring an end to the retaliatory tariffs on U.S. spirits products. They're doing great damage and certainly undercutting the industry's overall success. We're going to lobby on Capitol Hill in support of the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act that passed last year. This legislation will extend the federal excise tax reduction for distillers, brewers, and vintners. And as an industry, we're aligned on that. This important piece of legislation was introduced just last week, and it's enabled distillers to invest back in the businesses and communities across the country, driving job creation and advocating for American jobs. Another important issue is the TTB rulemaking on the modernization of labeling and advertising regulation. This is the first time in decades that these rules have been revised, and we're working closely with TTB. We're going to be fully engaged to ensure that the new regulations take into account a very ever-changing marketplace. At the state level, we hope to add South Carolina, West Virginia, North Carolina, and Texas to the current list of states that allow Sunday sales for spirits. We're also going to continue to pursue tastings in Georgia and in North Carolina, allowing consumers to try before you buy at special tasting events at liquor stores. On the international level, the USMCA, the United States Mexico-Canadian trade agreement is going to be considered by Congress. The president has agreed with Canada and Mexico to move forward in the replacement of NAFTA, and we're hoping and we're going to work with Congress for the passage of USMCA, while at the same time we're hoping that the retaliatory tariffs leveled by Canada and Mexico on spirits will also be resolved in the coming months. We're also nearing the deadline of potentially another government shutdown. The news reports suggested last night that Congress may have come to some kind of resolution on a deal. We'll wait to see. We're watching this closely. Our companies rely on TTB for prompt approval of beverage alcohol formulas, labels, and permits, and this is very important. For 35 days, TTB was essentially shut down with the last government shutdown. So we're hoping to work with TTB in case there's another shutdown in the future to ensure these approvals can get expedited in quick order. Spirits products generate billions in revenue for the state, federal, and local taxes and for the coffers of our government to operate. There's our hope that a resolution can be quickly solidified between Congress and the Trump administration to ensure there's no shutdown. Mm-hmm. So for that, you know, it's a proud time for the industry. We're growing and we're gaining market share. And it's a privilege for me to be back in the industry. The Distilled Spirits Council and Responsibility.org are great organizations. And I'm going to do my very best to lead this industry in the best way possible to advance our social responsibility interests and also to continue the growth for the industry. So with that, let me turn it over to David Osgo, and he'll take you through the details of the recent growth that we've had. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here before you all again. I believe this is the 19th year we've done this. We certainly enjoy doing it, and we're happy that we can provide you all with some information and hopefully a little education. That being said, there we go. That being said, what I'd like to do today is talk a little bit about the industry growth. And here I'll be talking exclusively about the U.S. domestic market. I'll talk about our market share gains. Now, when Spirits measures itself against, measures its market share, we measure ourselves against what we see as the competition, namely beer and wine. We'll look at what some of the growth drivers were in 2018, talk a little bit about some category performance, and we'll have information for you at the end. So if there's a number that you don't find in my presentation, trust me, we have it somewhere. I'll talk about some trends to watch. And then finally, you all might have noticed a little topic in the news lately called marijuana legalization. I'll talk a little bit about that and how it's impacting, or rather not impacting, the beverage alcohol industry. So as Chris mentioned, in 2018, spirits revenues grew by 5.1 percentage points. Now, when I talk about revenue, I'm going to be talking about U.S. supplier revenues. So everything here is measured in supplier revenues, unless I otherwise mention. So revenues grew 5.1% up to $27.5 billion. That's a gain of about $1.3 billion over 2017. This is the third or fourth year where revenues have grown by $1 billion or more. When we look at volumes are up 2.2% to 231 million 9-liter cases. That's a gain of 5 million cases over 2017. And again, over the last couple of years, we've kind of gotten to a nice solid pattern of 2 percentage points plus of volume growth. So that's a nice, very consistent growth pattern to have. Now, again, looking at our market share, when we talk about our market share, we're measuring ourselves against beer and wine, and here we're measuring supplier revenues. So it's spirit supplier revenues versus beer and wine suppliers. Market share grew to 37.3% in 2018. That's a gain of 0.7 points. Now, that might not sound like a whole lot, but in fact, each point of market share in the beverage alcohol industry at the supplier level is worth some $740 million. We've also gained market share in terms of share of stomach. Now, obviously, if we measured market share in volumes, if we just looked at straight volumes, well, you know, beer would have 80-90% of the volume. But really, that's not how people enjoy our products. So we convert everything into standard drinks, namely 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, and 1.5 ounces of spirits. After we convert everything into standard drinks, we have a share of stomach of about 35.3 percentage points. Again, a gain of about 0.7 points, similar to revenue. Each point of market share is worth about 6.5 million cases. So when you consider the fact that our volume grew by only 5 million cases in 2018, those market share gains are very, very important. The next set of slides I'm going to present, I'm going to talk about growth by price point. Now, we measure, we divide the world into four different price points: value, premium, high-end premium, and super premium. We do this by supplier price. Now, obviously, what constitutes a super premium product for vodka is not necessarily going to be a super premium price point for scotch or bourbon or cognac. So as a result, we have different price breaks for each one of these price categories. And again, we have this information for you. On average, and this is an average across the industry, across all categories, a value brand generates about $54 per 9 liters. A premium brand is around 100, high-end premium 170, and super premium 275. So with that in mind, looking at where our volume came in 2018, you see that the value brands generated around 74 million 9-liter cases, or about 32% of all industry volume. Premium was around 80 million cases, just under 80 million cases, and accounting for just under 35% of all industry volume. High-end premium was just under 54 million cases, or 23% of volume. Super premium makes up about 10.2% of all industry volume, or around just under 24 million cases. Going through the same exercise, only looking at revenues, while the value brands were, 32% of all industry volume, they only make up less than 15% of industry revenue, or about $4 billion. When we look at premium, it accounts for 28% of all industry volume, or $7.8 billion in revenue. High-end premium is just under a little over $9.2 billion in industry revenue. And then when we look at super premium, the total industry revenue that it generates is around $6.5 billion, or just under 24% of total industry volume, or revenue rather. Now, obviously, super premium generates just under 24% of industry revenue, but only accounts for 10% of industry volume. Looking at where the growth was by price point in 2018, comparing it to 2017, we see that, yes, in 2017, value brands were down by around 300,000 cases. 2018, they were down even more, 700,000 cases. Whereas we saw some about 1.6 million, a gain of about 1.6 million cases in the premium category in 2017. In 2018, premium price points were only up by about 120,000 cases. All the growth in 2018 was really in the high-end and super premium products. Now, it was heavily weighted in 2017. In 2018, the trend really extended itself. Whereas high-end premium volumes grew by 3.1 million cases in 2017, it was almost 4 million cases in 2018. Similarly, in 2018, super premium products grew by 600,000 cases more, 1.6 million cases, than in 2017. Looking at revenues, again, the trend continues where we had really no growth whatsoever in value and premium brand revenues. All the growth in high-end and super premium. Now, we've seen this pattern before, but I have to say, I've been doing this for 18 years now, and this is the first time that the growth has been really so lopsided. And what this really does is it screams millennial buying patterns. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Looking at our revenue per case and how it's grown since 2010, back in 2010, revenue per case was really around about $100 per case. Well, by 2018, that's up to $119 per 9 liters. Not hard to do the math there. It's a growth rate of around 19%. Now, yes, there have been some price increases in there, but a lot of this is due to this consumer trading up. Now, in 2018, what really drove this success? Well, there are a number of things. First off, the modern consumer is looking for a personalized experience. Everything you always hear about millennials is that they don't buy things, they want to buy experiences. Well, Distilled Spirits has really positioned itself to be perfectly situated for millennial buying habits. In addition to wanting that personalized experience, millennials like the cachet of the high-end and luxury products. They're willing to spend a little bit more for something that gives them a little bit more. Ultimately, our diversity of the spirits brands in categories when it comes to cocktails, again, think about the differences in flavor profiles for our various products. Think about all the brands within a specific category that will give you a slight nuance, and to think about all the ways that you can mix these products into a wonderful cocktail. It all leads nicely into that personalized experience a lot of the millennials are looking for. In addition to just the product quality and diversity that Spherix is bringing to the marketplace now, we've seen improved consumer access, whether that be through Sunday sales or tastings legislation. In the last 15, 20 years or so, tastings legislation has added the ability for you to taste a product in an off-premise establishment to 132 million people. That's a really huge increase. And let's face it, if you're going to spend $60, $70 on a bottle of spirits, you want to make certain that you like it. Ultimately, all of this wraps into spirits having a certain amount of social currency that's generated by its brand authenticity and its heritage. Let's move on now to some category results. One of the big stars of the show again in 2018, as it was the last few years, has been the American whiskey category. Volumes are up 5.9 percentage points. They now account for about 24.5 million cases. And this is across bourbon, Tennessee, rye, and the white or corn category. Obviously, this category is dominated by bourbon and Tennessee whiskey. Revenues were up 6.6% to about $3.6 billion. That's a gain of $224 million over 2018. As you can see, we saw strength across all price categories. And this is important because, yeah, you really want that growth in the high end and super premium. But the fact that you're having sales at some of the lower price points is really important. You have to get somebody into a category, obviously, before you can trade them up. When we looked at flavored whiskey, it was a little bit of a factor. It added about 200,000 cases. Looking strictly at bourbon and Tennessee whiskey, bourbon in Tennessee was up 6.4 percentage points, adding about 1.3 million cases. Only downside was the whiter corn category, which was down about 2.8%. But as it was last year, a really big trend is the growth in the American rye category. For the first time ever, it's broken the million case mark. It's grew about just under 16% in volume terms in 2018, up to 1.1 million 9-liter cases, accounting for about $205 million in supplier revenues. Another whiskey that did quite well in 2018 was Scotch. Scotch comes in either single malts or blended. When we looked at the single malt category, there was actually a real turnaround since 2017. 2017 was really the first year I can remember where single malt Scotch volumes were down. A little over 1%, but they were down nonetheless. Well, the single malt Scotch came back with a vengeance in 2017. Volumes are up 7.6%, revenues 9.4%, adding $843 million in supplier revenues. Similarly, blended Scotch was down slightly last year, had a limited amount of growth this year. It was up only 1% in volume terms, but in revenues grew by 4.6 percentage points. Now, obviously, this was because all of the growth was in the high-end and super premium categories, which, while it didn't drive volume growth, it really drove revenue growth. And then finally, Irish whiskey had another big year. Volumes are up over 10%, while revenues are up over 12%. And Irish whiskey is really well-placed to continue growth given the millennial buying patterns and the buying patterns that we've seen. Most of the products tend to be in the high-end and super premium category. Getting outside the whiskey category, tequila and mezcal. Obviously, most of these volumes, volume grew 7.7% to 18.5 million cases. Most of the case volume is in the tequila category. Revenues were up even faster. Similar to American whiskey, we saw strength across all price points, with particular strength in the high-end and super premium categories. Mezcal, however, had another big year. Volumes were up to close to 450,000 9-liter cases, revenue growing to around $90 million at the supplier level. It'll be interesting to see just how quick we saw earlier that rye whiskey now got over the million case mark. It'll be interesting to see how quickly Natal gets there. Cognac had a big year as well. Volumes were up 12.5%, adding 700,000 new cases. Revenues were up similarly, up over 14%. It now accounts for about $1.8 billion in supplier revenues in the U.S. market. And just like Irish whiskey, a lot of the volumes are concentrated in the high-end and super premium categories. Now, looking at gin and rum, in both cases, if you look at total category volumes, they were down slightly. However, when you look at the super premium category, for gin, volumes were up 14.7% to about 183,000 cases, with revenues growing even faster, and they now account for about $32 million. Rum volumes were down in total, but there is actually a little bit of growth in the high-end category, growing 0.9 of a point, and there is a lot of growth in the super premium category, with volumes up almost 27% and revenues up almost 29%. Oftentimes, what we'll see is before a category takes off, you'll see a lot of interest in the high-end and super premium categories. So it'll be interesting to see if that's the case with gin and rum next year. And of course, we always like to talk about vodka because vodka accounts for almost a third of all industry volume. And in 2018, volumes in the vodka category were up 1.6% to 72 million 9-liter cases. So that's 72 million cases out of 231. Clearly, it's an important category. Since almost all of the growth was in the high-end or in the high-end premium category, we saw faster revenue growth. Revenues were up 2.9 percentage points. We often look at the flavored vodka category. Flavored vodkas were down about 100,000 cases in 2018. So to sum up the experience that we had in 2018 in the spirits market, supplier revenues were up 5.1% to $27.5 billion. We had growth of 2.2% in volume terms, 231 million 9-liter cases. The real drivers in terms of category were bourbon and Tennessee, mezcal, cognac, tequila, rye whiskey, and Irish, and we continue to take market share. Now, let me turn for a few minutes to the question of marijuana legalization. Now, I want to say right off that the Distilled Spirits Council does not have to take a position on marijuana legalization. However, obviously, we've been following it with great interest. And one of the things I've been asked to do is to look at the states where marijuana has been legalized and try to determine if it's had any impact on spirits, has it had any impact on beverage alcohol. The only way that one can really determine what's happening in a state with regard to the total spirits market or the total beverage alcohol market is to look at excise tax data. All states have excise taxes. We wish they didn't, but they all do. So it's very easy to tell what total volumes are in a state just by looking at excise tax collections. They're all in volume terms, so a little simple division tells you what the total volume was. So what we did is we've looked at per capita consumption in each one of these states, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, and we've looked at it for various years. The red bars up here represent the first year prior to legalization for each state. And oh, by the way, we then indexed everything to 100, so it's a little bit easier to read than having a lot of lines bouncing all over. So we indexed everything to 100. The red bar is the year prior or the 12-month period prior to legalization in each state. The blue bar is 2 years prior, so you get a sense of what the trend was. And then the light green bar was the first year after legalization, or the first 12 months, the purple bar, the second 12 months, and then the light blue bar, the third 12 months. In the case of Washington and Oregon, there's an orange bar there, which represents the fourth 12-month period following legalization. As you can see, when we look at the index of per capita consumption, well, this is for distilled spirits. Volumes have actually increased. Now, it's significant that we looked at Oregon, Washington, and Colorado because clearly marijuana is not legalized nationwide. It's only in selected states right now. But these markets have had legalized marijuana for so long that to a large extent, they're really mature markets, particularly in Colorado. I was looking at the growth of marijuana sales a few days ago. And well, as it turns out, as you might expect, in 2014, they legalized. 2015, retail sales were up 100%. No big surprise. 2016, they're up 50%. Again, rapid growth. 2017, 25%. 2018, 12%. This is a rapidly maturing market where they've had dramatic drops in prices, which is what you would expect when you no longer have that really, really rapid growth. People start fighting over market share. So the point is that in Colorado, this is very much a mature marketplace. Anyone that's ever visited Colorado in the last few years, marijuana is perfectly, it's socially acceptable. So anyway, in these very mature marketplaces, Pierce has not seen any impact. In fact, we've actually seen some growth in per capita consumption. Now, obviously, spirits has been growing across the country. Well, what about total beverage alcohol? Well, again, going through the same exercise where I converted spirits, beer, and wine into standard drinks to get a sense of total per capita consumption, when you look at that chart, it's actually kind of boring. Looking at Oregon compared in the third 12-month period compared to the year before, well, per capita consumption is down half a point. Washington State, 4 years after legalization, it's down 0.2%. And Colorado, it's actually up 1.7 percentage points. This is for total beverage alcohol. You can look at these, you can go through this exercise in just about any state, whether marijuana has or has not been legalized for recreational purposes, and see very similar results. Yes, there's a little bouncing around, but there's really nothing major. So I can't tell you if 10 years from now, marijuana will have an impact on the beverage alcohol industry. But from the results I've seen so far, it has not had an impact. Looking at some spirits trends in 2019 and what's going to drive the industry in 2019, were a couple things that are really fascinating. First off, there's an accelerating interest in American-made products, whether that be, obviously, first it was bourbon or Tennessee. Now it's rye, and we're also seeing the development of an American single malt industry. I didn't put up any data for it. The volumes are quite small at this point, but what I will say is there are a lot of brands out there coming into the marketplace. So that'll be interesting to follow. Distillers continue to experiment with different cask finishes, with hybrid products and whatnot. Well, it's that experimentation that ultimately allows for more and more personalized experiences. We know that it's the personalized experience that's driving a lot of the interest in the category, so that will help drive sales in the future. Be bespoke. Consumers are talking to their bartenders. They're telling them what they want. Bartenders are engaging in dialogue. This is really important. I mean, there's no better advertising for a product than, say, the bartender that you're working with. So the fact that we're having discussions about preferred flavors and, I've been in bars where, the bartender asks you, what do you like? And sometimes he'll craft. Now, I don't know if he's made this drink especially for me, but I do know that it's not on the menu. I've told him what I like. And lo and behold, he gives me a drink that just knocks my socks off. Bitter appreciation. It's not just the base spirit that people are talking about or that's gained the consumer's interest of late. A lot of bartenders today now are actually even making their own bitters. So if you've gotten to the point where it's not just the base spirit in the cocktail, but it's the bitters, we see people making a lot of their own tonic waters. In a lot of instances, bartenders will tell you what ice that they're going to use in your drink. This isn't just the on-premise category. Probably 3 months ago, we went to some friend's house for drinks and dinner, and lo and behold, he was serving me drinks that he made with his own bitters. So it's not just millennial bartenders that are doing this, it's 50-year-old lawyers as well. Rare spirits as an investment. Just about every other week, you see another auction where they've auctioned off a bottle of scotch or tequila or cognac or whatnot. That's breaking records. Well, obviously, such sales aren't showing up in our data because they're in the secondary market. But what they do is they drive a lot of interest. And it also allows the distillers to come up with special limited editions that the consumer really, really likes and really enjoys. And millennials, as I said, don't just buy products, they buy experiences. But additionally, they want a sense that you share their values. They want a sense that your train of thought is consistent with them. So increasingly, there's been a lot of brand involvement with social causes and charitable giving. It's really a whole lifestyle. Again, you're not buying a product, you're buying an experience. And we're seeing more and more mindful drinking, from fashion cocktails, sustainability to locally sourced ingredients and whatnot. Again, it's the millennials are buying into that experience. Anyway, with that, we'll have a question and answer period here later on. I'm going to introduce my colleague, Christine LaCascia, who is our Senior Vice President for International Trade.
Hello, everyone. So let's talk a little bit about how we fared on the export side this year. Well, I'm very pleased to report that through November, we've achieved a new record. We are almost approaching $1.7 billion in U.S. spirits exports globally. But at the same time, we're facing the most challenging period for our exporters than probably we ever have, which has increased the amount of uncertainty for our exporters. So typically when we do this presentation, we feel pretty comfortable projecting out with our November data, projecting that out for the rest of the year. Because of that uncertainty, we're not doing that this year, and we're just focusing on data through November. So just want to clarify that. So the 15% there represents the amount of growth that we saw year on year between 2016 and 2017. So why is it the most challenging period we've ever faced? Between 2016 and 2017 was the 15% rate. Apologies. So why is it the most challenging period? Well, since the summer, U.S. spirits valued at $763 million, that's based on 2017 full year data, are now subject to retaliatory tariffs due to trade disputes, which have nothing to do with the spirits sector, but which unfortunately we are caught in the middle of. So U.S. whiskeys, which are a very important export sector for us, are now facing a 10% tariff in Canada, 25% on our exports to the EU and Mexico, 140% to Turkey, and anywhere and all U.S. spirits, I'm sorry, face 140% tariff in Turkey, and then between 15 and 30% tariff in China. So what has this meant for our whiskey export? Well, we decided to look at it a little more granularly this year than we have in the past. So when we look at our year-to-date exports, 2018 to 2017, it looks like we're, you know, almost at about the same level. But when you look at it for the first half of the year before the tariffs were imposed, because the first tariff started to be imposed in mid-June, we saw a 28% increase from January through June 2018 compared with the same period in 2017. But that sort of follows the trend from previous years. We've seen this, you know, global increase in interest in American whiskeys following what's happening in the U.S. and around the world, particularly in bourbon, Tennessee whiskey, and now rye as well. Once the tariffs were imposed, now that we look at the period of July to November 2018 compared to 2017, we're starting to see it flattening out and going into the negative range. So we're down 8.2% comparing the same period with 2017. So that suggests to us that the tariffs are starting to have a negative impact on our exports. And why is this so important? Well, let's look back at 2017 again. So 2017, our global spirits exports were totaled $1.6 billion. 69% of those are whiskey. So whiskey is so important for our exporters. It accounted for $1.1 billion worth of export sales in 2017. Of that $1.1 billion, 59% of those went to the EU alone, so the 28 countries in the EU. So the EU market is extremely important for our exporters. So hence the 25% tariff to that market on whiskey is particularly harmful. So let's look at how we did in the past. Our U.S. whiskey exports to the EU, we've seen, you know, over the past 10 years or so had been on a steady increase. And between 2016 and 2017, we had an increase of 17% of our sales of whiskey to the EU alone. Now, when we look specifically at our whiskey exports to the EU, again, they're now subject to a 25% tariff as of June 22nd, 2018. Looking at the first half of the year, our exports were up 33% compared to the previous year, the same period. The tariffs were imposed, and now looking at the period from July to November, exports are down at the rate of 8.7%, again, looking at the same period. So it certainly appears to us to be having an impact on our sales, our exports. Now we're looking at another important market, Canada, which imposed a 10% tariff as of July 1. We had a 12.4% increase in the first half of the year compared to 2017, and now we're seeing a decrease in the second half of the year of negative 8.3%. So one of the things, you know, we have been doing, you know, tapping into the growing small distiller movement around the United States, we have been working very closely with small distillers to help them export, particularly over the past 5 years. We partner with USDA as part of their market access program to try and connect U.S. small distillers with importers, distributors, and export markets. And we've had a lot of success with that program to the tune of almost $5 million in new exports for at least 12 small distillers over the past 5 years. So more and more small distillers are looking to export markets as the U.S. market is becoming more competitive because there are so many more small distillers active in this market now. And so as a result, we were actually surprised to see this data that in 2017, 42 states exported U.S. spirits. And in terms of whiskey, 37 states exported American-made whiskey in 2017. So as a result of the tariffs, many of the small distillers are on the front line of seeing the impact of the tariffs to their business from day one of the imposition of the tariffs. And many of these small distillers have been raising their concerns, you know, with their congressmen, with press to demonstrate what the impact is to their specific companies and their communities. So at this point, I'd like to ask Scott Harris with Catoctin Creek, one of our small distillers, to talk about his company and the impacts of the tariffs on his ability to export. Thank you.
Thank you guys for having me here. Thank you to the council also for the invitation to speak. I am Scott Harris, and I am half of the founding team at Catoctin Creek. My wife Becky and I started the company this Thursday. It'll be 10 years ago. So it's an unusual gift to give your wife for Valentine's Day, a life of indentured servitude at a distillery. We've been in business for 10 years, and just to give you a little snapshot of what our business looks like, we do employ about 20 people, and we have grown since we started into about 26 states in the U.S., and we had an emerging EU business, particularly a little bit to Singapore as well. As of about 5 years ago, when we first started the business, there were very few craft distillers, and especially in the rye whiskey category that we're in. And as we grew our business about 5 years in, competition from U.S. companies really started to take hold. And so we were looking for ways to continue to expand our business. And so the European market was one that we looked at first. Obviously, culturally speaking, Europe is very similar to the U.S., and so it's much easier, in my view, to understand how to get into Europe and sell there than it would be, say, China, where I have not as much knowledge on the ground. So we started that effort in coordination with the Distilled Spirits Council, USDA MAP funding. We also make use of monies from places like SUSTA and Virginia Department of Agriculture, all of whom have trade mission type trips that we can use to offset some of our costs to encourage U.S. agricultural exports. whiskey being, of course, the coolest U.S. agriculture export out there. In our business, just to show you a slice of the economic impact that we represent as a small distiller, when we have lower sales, that affects not just our own bottom line and the families of 20 employees that we have, but also we have four farms that we source from for our rye whiskey. We have a fifth and sixth farms that are cattle farms that we give our spent mash to that offsets their cost for cattle farming. We source all of our materials for the bottles in the U.S. So that means the glass coming from Anchor Hocking in Western Pennsylvania, the closures coming from South Carolina. So this has an impact that spreads, you know, beyond further than just our little hometown. And our company is a small company, but it represents about 1,000 companies in every single state in the nation. And as Christine said, 42 of which are exporting overseas. So there's a multiplier effect that really starts to add up. The story I'd tell you then about how this all has affected us is 5 years ago, we started going to Germany and looking for export opportunities. And in that 5 years, you know, we've spent probably about $100,000 of sales or of money for conferences, travel, new labels, bottle designs, consultants overseas that help us on the ground in Europe, and all those kinds of costs. And in that time, we had built a small business starting to grow in places like Germany, Italy. And in 2018, March, April timeframe, we had a trade mission trip to the UK. We wanted to get our products into the UK. If you look at per capita consumption figures for Europe, 1 through 25, each country, you know, on that list. If you take number one, which is the UK, it's greater by far than number 2 through 25 added together. So the Brits are doing all the drinking in Europe. And so it's an important market to get into. And so we had a trade mission trip to London, and the Virginia Department of Agriculture had set us up with meetings for some very high-end establishments like the Savoy, Claridge's, Cadenhead's, and Harrod's, and places like that. And we had some very good meetings, and we came away from that trip with a handshake agreement with our distributor to be in Europe or in UK, and handshake agreements to get our products into those very nice establishments. We were very excited and very energized by this. And then that was second quarter of 18. And then, of course, by third quarter 18, the tariffs had hit. And our distributor completely stopped returning phone calls, stopped answering emails, completely ghosted us. And we never heard from him since. Without a distributor, obviously, it's very difficult to get into any of those businesses. We had planned in 2018, 25% of our company's revenue to be represented from the EU. And at the end of 2018, that had been very, very close to zero. We had maintained some small imports into Italy, where we've had a five-year relationship with an importer. But in Italy, we are eating the cost of the tariffs to continue that relationship. One of the dangers of these types of tariff situations for us, and for, I think, us as a greater spirits community, is not just the loss of market share, but what we really worry about is the loss of mind share as well. So in Europe, just like here in the U.S., there's an enormous boom in craft spirits and interest in that. And there is also a very high esteem for American spirits. And with American spirits sitting it out, so to speak, other spirits are going to fill that void. There are spirits producers making all categories of spirits, whether it's rye whiskey or corn whiskey, which you can't call bourbon, but it's corn whiskey from Germany. All of those categories are being made and addressed, and that gives them a chance to get into the market. And just like with the soybeans, once that market is gone, it's hard to get back into it. So we're really concerned about that loss of mind share and people drinking other spirit alternatives as opposed to American spirits. So that's our story, and it's unfortunately not a good one. We presently are treading water, I like to say, while we wait to see if these tariff negotiations can continue and get back to the table. I don't see a lot of reason for hope right now on that, but hopefully we get some progress on that in the next 6 months would be wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. Sorry about that.
We're going to fix that for you, hopefully. And,
But I think the interesting point that Scott's made is the connection to agriculture. And distilled spirits for 200 years have been the epitome of value-added agriculture, and since George Washington's time. So we'll go to the Q&A now. We'll start in the room, and then we'll go to the phone lines. So if you'll raise your hand, we'll call on you and just announce who you are. Francine.
Thank you all for being here. Always annually, and particularly today, because I know the weather's horrible out there. I'm wondering what kind of conversation is happening between the council and the administration in terms of deleterious impact that these tariffs are having on businesses like Scott's, and then by extension on our agriculture. I mean, I know this is an administration with a mission to make America great again. And if our businesses aren't thriving, then we're not great.
Hi, Francine. Chris Swanger.
Nice to meet you, Chris.
Nice to meet you. Thank you for coming. Yeah, obviously, you know, there's different points of view in terms of the tactics that the Trump administration, you know, has imposed upon in terms of trying to address broad trade challenges for the United States, right? We recognize these tariffs are retaliatory as a result of that. We're working with Christine very much with the administration to try to raise awareness and understanding that these tariffs are having an impact not only on the large distillers, but just as importantly or more importantly, the Scotts of the world, right? So we are meeting with the U.S. Department of Commerce, U.S. Trade Rep, the White House, the administration, really to encourage to get the trade agreement resolved. The USMCA certainly needs to pass Congress, and certainly we support that. But an important aspect of that is resolving the tariffs between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And in addition, as you saw in the slides, the big impact is with the EU. So, and certainly China, we'll see what happens on March 1st when additional tariffs may come in the line unless the U.S. and China come to some agreement. So we're working very, very hard. We're somewhat dependent on broader trade negotiations to come in line. But we're going to raise awareness, help people understand the impact, and hopefully some of these big issues will get resolved soon. Most importantly, the tariffs on the distilled spirits industry.
Christine, do you have anything to add? I know you've had dozens of meetings.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chris covered it all. I would just say, you know, part of our message is just to encourage continued dialogue and enhance dialogue as part of that. So just keep talking to one another and find a resolution so that the tariffs can be lifted.
Karen?
Okay. Hi. So my question is related to the share of stomach. It looks like spirits are definitely getting more overall, but the overall stomach seems to be getting a bit smaller. My question is about what are you seeing in terms of the total amount of spend on alcoholic beverages altogether?
Well, the spend is definitely going up. I mean, even when you look at spirits, beer, and wine, the price points are moving up. And that's the case for wine, it's the case for spirits, and it's the case for beer. I haven't looked specifically at the retail spending, but when I looked at supplier revenues for all three categories, those amounts were going up. Now, beer volumes obviously were down. I think wine was either flat or down slightly, but the revenue is going up, and that's always a good thing. The total number of drinks appears on a per capita basis to be remaining constant.
Back to the room. Alan?
Thanks very much, Alan Rappaport with the New York Times. Has it been difficult at all to make the case that the tariffs are hurting the industry when revenues have been continuing to grow steadily and are at record numbers?
Well, I mean, I think the longer this goes on, it'll give us a clearer picture of what's happening in terms of just our total exports. You know, and there is a delay in some of the data that we get, but certainly, you know, setting that aside, you know, we have Scots of the world that are, you know, certainly facing immediate impacts to the tariffs. And so, you know, there are many companies like Scots that have had canceled contracts, you know, have had to, you know, not hire additional employees, have had to hold off on expansion. So those are sort of the concrete immediate results that we're seeing of the impacts of the tariffs. The longer this goes on, it'll give us, you know, a clearer sense of, you know, the impact on total exports. We hope it doesn't go on for much longer. But maybe Scott has something else to add to that.
Yeah, I would also maybe add our U.S. business was up, which is nice. You know, as a small business, it would be nice to have some of that in Europe as well, obviously, a little more profit to reinvest into our business. So we are holding off on expansion of equipment, you know, for more capacity until this is a little more resolved. So that is one aspect of it. And I had another thought, but it's escaping me at the moment. So sorry about that.
Other question in the back?
Two quick questions. One for David. Do you have the data that you presented today also broken down on an off-premise?
No, we don't. What I present here is always supplier shipments. So obviously that's a movement from the supplier to the wholesaler. So as a result, we don't actually collect that data in this form.
Correct me if I'm wrong, David. The off-premise represents about 70%.
Yeah, off-premise is about 70, 75, 80%, depending upon which state you're looking at. It can go as low as 60 in a state with a big tourist industry like, say, Nevada. But in general, it's 75 to 80% off-premise.
Christine, just a quick question on your breakouts from the first half of the year to the second. Was there any loading that went on prior to the tariff increases?
Yes, I think probably some of the larger companies seeing, you know, the threats of the tariffs being made, you know, several months prior to the imposition of them. Doing that, I think, and some of them have actually, you know, indicated that they did do some of that in the first half of the year to kind of get ahead of it.
Other questions? Oh, Jerry.
Hi, Jerry Kamush, Beer Marketers Insights, Beverage Business Insights. There's been a lot of buzz and coverage about non-alcoholic cocktail bars, millennials, a lot of millennials opting not to drink alcohol. Looking at your data, it's very hard to see that it's had any kind of impact at all, but I'm just wondering if qualitatively or quantitatively you're picking any of that up.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of buzz, and in fact, a number of remember companies have entered products into those categories. You know, you're right. In the data that we've looked at, we really cannot find any particular impact on overall volumes. You know, so as a certain extent, you know, perhaps what they're doing is substituting, you know, a non-alcoholic spirit or non-alcoholic wine, whatever the case may be, for an occasion that previously maybe they're drinking sparkling water. You know, just because a category is growing doesn't necessarily mean that it's taking away from beverage alcohol.
Anything else in the room? If not, oh, yes, in the front from Donna.
Hi, this is Liu from Xinhua News Agency of China. For question for Christy. Do you have, as Chinese market is relatively small for U.S. spirits, do you have any specific debt in this regard for an IT?
Yes, it is a relatively small market for us. Through November, exports totaled about $17.2 million.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. I'm wondering, when you mentioned millennial trends, are you looking at specific demographic data, or are you connecting the dots between external research to your own figures?
Who are you with?
I'm Danielle with CNN Business.
Got it. Yeah, we're connecting the dots from what millennials have told us as to what their, you know, their motivation is, what their reasons are. Obviously, this is supplier shipment data, so you can't necessarily, you know, look at a shipment from a supplier to a wholesaler and say, well, that definitively was going to a millennial. But from everything that we've heard, everything that they tell us, that's how we draw the inference.
Question? Fleming.
David Fleming from M. Shankin. You talked a little bit about marijuana legalization and how you're more or less agnostic on the topic, but what about regulation? Where do you stand on issues of like driving while impaired or legal smoking ages or whatever you want to call them? Where are you? Have you weighed in on that?
I mean, obviously, we're looking at that closely. I think it's probably fair to say the cannabis industry, you know, could certainly look at, you know, the regulation of beverage alcohol as a potential model. It's a moving target, with 10 states legalizing the product. So there's a lot of unanswered questions about that I think we're all reviewing. So I think it's a wait to be seen, you know, should it fall within the three-tiered system or should it not, right? Obviously, we're focused on the rise in impaired driving because our industry has a lot of investment in addressing traffic safety issues and so forth. So I've seen in my 2 months, you know, being back in the industry, I think there's a recognition by the cannabis industry to be on the front foot on social responsibility standards. And I think we're going to do our part to try to help in that regard because it's critically important.
And we do have board policy in that area, those areas, three areas. Anyone else? If not, we'll take a call from the question from the phone. Anybody on the phone would like to ask a question, announce who you are and what your outlet is.
Frank, it's Mark Gillespie from WhiskeyCast. Can you hear me?
Yes.
The question I have is for Christine. Perhaps by coincidence, certainly probably not by planning, we also got the Scotch whiskey export data today from HM Revenue and Customs through the Scotch Whiskey Association, and they're reporting another record year for Scotch whiskey exports, including some gains in places like India and other developing markets. With the retaliatory tariffs on bourbon and other American whiskeys, is there a possibility that we could, in this country, lose some ground to Scotch whiskey in those developing markets because of the tariffs that could affect the long-term growth of American whiskey exports?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what markets you're talking about. Scotch whiskey and American whiskey face the same tariffs in India, which are 150%. Certainly, I think one of the things, you know, Scott had talked about is with regard to the EU market and with the UK, you know, potentially leaving that market and the great uncertainty that surrounds all of that, as the tariffs continue to apply to American whiskey exports to the EU, you know, that creates, you know, maybe some opportunities there for the Scotch whiskey market to take some market share away from, you know, American whiskey exports to the EU. So it's all kind of related, but I think it does depend on what market you're talking about.
Of course, they're grappling with Brexit.
And a quick follow-up. Have you seen any indication at all from Washington or from the administration and the trade diplomats there that they're actually worried about this impact on the whiskey industry?
Yes, I mean, I would say, you know, they're very receptive and they understand the concerns. All of the meetings that we've had with the senior level officials there, they're certainly aware of it. And you know, we're not the only sector that's subject to retaliatory tariffs. You know, there are several others as well. you know, all of this is, you know, again, we're caught in the middle of trade disputes that, you know, have to do with the steel industry, which have nothing to do with us. But I think they understand those concerns, but it's all part of a strategy, I think, on the administration's part to achieve some objectives, you know, relative to other sectors and concerns, for example, China being the biggest one on IP and tech transfer.
Thank you.
Someone else on the phone? Anyone else on the phone have a question? If not, 3, 2, 1 for the good of the order. I close this session. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for braving the weather. Drive safely or walk safely or whatever you're going to be doing.